Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marcus Raskin, longtime peace and justice activist and co-founder of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses today's peace movement opposing the U.S. war and occupation of Iraq. Michael Clare, professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, who examines the intensifying global struggle to capture petroleum resources. And Wade Henderson, executive director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, who takes a critical look at the consequences of the Republican Party's likely attempt to abolish the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
American gasoline prices are quickly climbing toward the $3 mark for a gallon of premium grade and are making consumers, politicians, and investors nervous. Beyond normal seasonal fluctuations, the rising price of crude oil reveals the growing economic clout of China and India, the world's fastest-growing economies. According to the news magazine In These Times, China is the second biggest importer of oil behind the U.S., and its oil consumption will probably double by 2020, predicts Wall Street economist Stephen Roach. With its growing thirst for energy, China and India are looking towards Iran, the second largest oil exporter with big reserves of natural gas to meet their needs. Since January, both nations have signed multi-billion dollar deals with Iran and have talked about increasing military cooperation with the Persian Gulf nation. This complicates efforts by the U.S. and the European Union to pressure Iran into giving up its nuclear programs. During the winter, China made a lucrative oil deal with Colombia and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela to build a new oil terminal that will bypass the Panama Canal. Over the next decade, both China and India plan to boost domestic oil and gas production, which has attracted the interest and investment of major oil giants like ExxonMobil. Located in the Andes Mountains of northern Peru is Yanacocha, one of the world's most profitable gold mines, which is owned by Denver's Newmont Mining. At five different sites, giant earth movers load 300,000 tons of rock a day into trucks. The material is later treated with a cyanide solution. The end result is an ounce of gold for each ton of rocks mined. The 1990s were a boom time for Peru's gold mines, which tripled mining activity. Last fall, resistance grew as local farmers campaigned against further expansion at Yanacocha, fearing increased toxic pollution. The farmers won, and Newmont pulled back its prospecting plans. But according to The Economist magazine, this is just one of a growing number of anti-mine campaigns in Peru's gold belt. In November 2004, a group of 350 people ransacked and burned a gold prospecting camp. A month later, the border area with Ecuador was closed after a two-day protest against expanded mining. Currently, mining accounts for 29% of Peru's tax revenue. Father Marco Arana, who is working with peasants opposed to expanded gold mining, says there are two main objections: the environmental impact of mining and the lack of economic benefits to poor farmers who live near the mines. Peasants who oppose Newmont's expansion plans have seen local irrigation channels dry up and higher levels of river silt kill fish. Critics also cite the long history of mines dumping toxic materials across Peru's lands and waters. After a decade of intense grassroots campaigns by anti-sweatshop activists, major clothing retailers like Nike and The Gap have now admitted that they exploited cheap labor. As a result, the clothing companies are now devising new relationships with fair trade activists. In mid-April, Nike, the longtime target of anti-sweatshop campaigns, published detailed lists of 700 contract companies that made its sports shoes and found that a quarter of these factories did not meet minimum standards for pay, work hours, and working conditions. In recent months, The Gap made its own corporate confession in a revealing social responsibility report that acknowledged unhealthy working conditions in factories in Mexico, China, Russia, and India. In response, The Gap canceled contracts with 136 factories after the company's own report disclosed cases of child labor and some workers putting in more than 80 hours a week. According to the London-based Independent newspaper, the corporate confessions demonstrate the effectiveness of activist tactics to target the clothing brands, undermining the image that Nike and The Gap spent millions of advertising dollars to create. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
With the recent escalation of violence by insurgents in Iraq that includes daily attacks on U.S. and Iraqi forces, car bombings, and kidnappings, the optimistic picture recently painted by the White House and Pentagon officials of diminishing violence, stability, and a short-term reduction in the number of American occupation troops seems ever more implausible. Meanwhile, nations such as Italy and the Ukraine that had initially deployed soldiers to support the Bush administration's occupation of Iraq are now steadily withdrawing. While differences outnumber similarities between the Iraq War and the U.S. war in Vietnam, there are a growing number of observers who are concerned that the Bush administration may be making the same critical mistakes that led to the American defeat and withdrawal from South Vietnam 30 years ago. Critics and supporters of Washington's war in Southeast Asia, haunted by the deaths of 58,000 American troops and more than a million Vietnamese, have drawn very different lessons from the Vietnam conflict. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Marcus Raskin, co-founder of the Institute for Policy Studies in 1963 and a vocal opponent of the Vietnam War and military draft. Raskin assesses the current peace movement's demand for a rapid U.S. withdrawal from Iraq and the lessons he believes should have been learned in Vietnam.
Well, I think that if you look at the Vietnam War, there was an election in September of 1967 in South Vietnam. And the assumption in the press and among people in the administration was, you see, this election is working, and it will result in the stabilization of the South Vietnamese government, and everything is going to be hunky-dory. The same sort of crude understanding of life of another culture is happening in Iraq. There's nothing to suggest, at least at this point, and there's nothing on the horizon to suggest that the attempt to have an election or an election on top of what is now an incipient civil war, that it will result in any sort of quiet and allowing the United States to leave. Furthermore, though, there is in this case no apparent reason that the United States will leave. It wants to have the bases in the Middle East. It wants to be the nation that is able to guide where the oil is supposed to go, etc. And it wants to establish itself directly as the nation that has a sphere of influence over that area.
By all accounts, military recruitment is down. And there are real prospects out there that a draft may be established, reestablished in this country soon. What do you think the response of the peace movement who want a quick withdrawal of U.S. troops from the occupation of Iraq, what do you think the peace movement should be doing now?
I think that there are several things that should go on. One is obviously the increase of marches and demonstrations, which I think does have an effect. I think also there is a whole question of legitimacy of the war. That is to say, it's based on a lie. There are no weapons of mass destruction, on and on. That the president had no intention of following whatever the intelligence said, that he and Blair wanted to make war and had planned to do this several years ago. So that this was an aggressive war, that being an aggressive war, it's something which is violative of the Nuremberg principles, which the United States supported as it related to the German war criminals. Furthermore, and that's just a part of an argument, furthermore, it strikes me as mistaken in the extreme not to raise the question of either censure or impeachment with regard to the president and his cabinet, and at least the president, in order to make clear that these people indeed have acted in an unlawful way.
Just a final question, if I could. Many half-truths and blatant lies were told in justifying the Iraq war on the part of the Bush administration, but our government seems unaccountable for these breaches of trust. In fact, policymakers have been rewarded with promotions and medals and re-election. The press was blamed for the loss of the Vietnam War, by conservatives who supported that conflict. And it seems that the press here in the United States has been asleep at the switch, to say the least, in terms of scrutinizing and challenging the rationales for war in Iraq.
Well, I think that's right. And for the most part, our press is what you could call a palace court press. That is to say, it takes handouts and is more willing to take propaganda than doing individual or critical research on various questions. And it's a great shame, because what that means is that the people of this country suffer as a result of it. This issue is going to become more and more important as people, in any case, move away from reading newspapers and dependent on the mass media such as television, which indeed only tells a fleeting glimpse of any story. So the country is faced with a very, very great problem now in terms of how news is gathered, how criticism is made, and how it gets out.
Any lessons you want to impart from what you learned during the Vietnam War and your activism against that conflict?
I think that there's one principle, and that is less a principle, I think, than a stance. And that is that unless you speak out and act, the social and political space will close down. The only way to keep open that social and political space is to use it.
That was Marcus Raskin, longtime peace activist and co-founder of the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. Raskin, along with Carl Lavin, are the editors of a new book titled In Democracy's Shadow, The Secret World of National Security. Michael Clare, professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, is one of the foremost experts on the politics of oil. He has written widely on the subject, with his most recent book, Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Dependency on Imported Oil, addressing the intensifying international struggle to capture petroleum resources. Professor Clare was the keynote speaker at a Yale University conference on global oil frontiers on April 29th. His topic was Petroleum Flows and Political Conflict, in which he addressed three topics: the shortfall between demand and supply and increased competition for the oil that remains, the historic shift in world oil production from the global north to the global south, and the increasing militarization of national policies to protect countries' access to oil. Here we present an excerpt of Professor Clare's speech.
The Department of Energy assumes that the global demand for petroleum will continue to rise at a very high level over the coming 20 years. That's as far as their predictions go at present, out to 2025. This is true because of continuing high demand for petroleum in the United States, which uses one-fourth of all the world's oil on a daily basis and is expected to continue to do so for as far as we could see into the future. Most of our oil is used for transportation, especially ground transportation, especially private vehicles, but also for airplanes and ships and diesel trains and the like. And Americans are driving more all the time. They're driving less and less fuel-efficient vehicles over the past decade. At present, the developing countries use only one-third of world oil, but in 2025, they're expected to use half of world oil at a much higher level. So the Department of Energy, combining rising demand in the developing world and steady demand in the industrial countries, predicts that world oil demand will increase by 50%, a huge amount, between 2000 and 2025. This is going to be a Herculean task for the world's oil industry, costing trillions of dollars and requiring heroic efforts of exploration and development. The fact that no new vast discoveries have been made on the scale of the oil fields found in the 1950s and 1960s since then suggests that it's highly unrealistic that the world oil industry is going to be able to match the anticipated demand. And this is going to pit the oil-consuming countries against one another in fierce competition for the available supplies, fierce competition. This will lead to economic pressures, economic competition, which we see now with higher prices, but I fear it's also going to lead to political pressures and risk-taking behavior. Now, that's the first factor that I wanted to mention. Now, couple this with the second aspect of the problem that troubles me, and that is this historic shift from the global north to the global south and the location of the remaining supply of oil. As recently as 1950, two-thirds of the world's oil came from the global north, from those countries, and only a third from the developing world. But now it's exactly the other way around. All of the fields in the global north are in decline or at a peak production and are about to decline, and there's very little prospect of new oil coming on stream in the developed parts of the world. Almost all of the large untapped fields are in the global south, in the Middle East, in Africa, in Latin America, and in the Caspian Sea Basin. The problem here is that almost all of these countries are fundamentally unstable or corrupt or authoritarian or live in dangerous neighborhoods or are subject to civil wars or separatist conflicts or border disputes or house anti-American terrorists or insurgents of one sort. All of them are prone to instability. And this is not a coincidence. It's a product of partly of their imperial past. All of these countries, or most of them, were under the control of the imperial powers at one time or another. U.S. troops are now helping to guard the pipeline from the Caspian, the BTC pipeline in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. There are American troops in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. We're building bases in Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan. All of this supposedly part of the war against terror, but if you read the congressional requests for appropriations, you find what they mean by anti-terrorism is protecting oil wells and oil pipelines and oil loading facilities in the Caspian Sea. The war against terror has become a war to protect America's foreign oil interests. I truly believe that the issues of oil will now become the decisive issues in the lives of everyone on the planet. Freeing ourselves from the addiction to cheap oil is the most pressing moral and political and economic and environmental issue of our time.
That was Michael Clare, professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. Call the study program at area code 413-559-5367. Or visit their website at pawss.hampshire.edu. Professor Clare's talk was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. As the likelihood that the Republican majority in the U.S. Senate will soon use extraordinary parliamentary maneuvers to eliminate the filibuster, the Democratic minority's only tool to block lifetime judicial appointments they view as extremist, TV ads from groups on both sides of the issue are hitting the airwaves. The GOP idea of abolishing the filibuster, a Senate institution for over 200 years, has infuriated Senate Democrats and led them to threaten non-cooperation in future legislative matters if the so-called nuclear option is approved. Senate Democrats used the filibuster to block 10 of President Bush's 45 nominees to federal appeals courts during his first term. Since being reelected, Mr. Bush has now renominated 7 of those nominees, including Judges Priscilla Owen and Janice Rogers Brown. At stake is not only the current appointments to federal appeals courts, but the U.S. Supreme Court, where at least one vacancy is expected in the coming year. As this fight heats up, a Washington Post ABC News poll recently found that a majority of Americans, by a 2-to-1 margin, oppose the GOP plan to eliminate the filibuster. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Wade Henderson, executive director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, part of a coalition of groups working to prevent a filibuster rules change. Henderson takes a critical look at President Bush's nominees and the consequences he sees of abolishing the Senate filibuster.
Let me say at the outset that the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights is the nation's premier civil and human rights coalition. We have over 185 national organizations working together to support the advancement of civil and human rights. Our coalition is opposed to Senator Frist's proposal of the so-called nuclear option, which is a procedural change of Senate rules that would make it possible for a simple majority of 51 senators to literally confirm any nominee, either judicial or executive branch nominee, who is put before the Senate without regard to qualifications on a simple party-line vote. It does not limit, however, the rule change to nominations alone. It would also allow legislation to be approved with a simple majority vote, thus changing a Senate procedural rule that's been in place for over 200 years. Now, when the founders of our own representative democracy got together to establish our tripartite system of government, they created, of course, an executive branch, a legislative branch, and a judicial branch. What we're talking about here are the confirmation of federal judicial nominees to a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court and or lower courts. And what this rule change would do is make it possible for a president to nominate someone as out of the mainstream as one could imagine and still have that individual confirmed to this lifetime appointment on the court by a simple majority of 51 senators. Because Republicans in the Senate now number 55 votes with 44 Democrats and one independent, even if Republicans voted exclusively along party lines, they would guarantee the confirmation of every nominee. Now, currently, this debate is really not what I think most Americans understand it to be. That is to say, the president has nominated about 215 appointees to the federal courts, of whom 205 have been confirmed. In other words, over 96% of President Bush's nominees to the federal court have been confirmed. The Senate has blocked about 10 of these nominees. And the 10 nominees that have been blocked are among the most out of the mainstream, the most extremely conservative ideologues who often shape their own views of the court in substitute for precedents established by higher courts in their own jurisdiction.
Wade Henderson, what do you think the motivation here is of the Republican Party to take this historic and unprecedented action? They talk about discrimination against judges who hold Christian beliefs and that somehow this is bias against people of religion. What is your thoughts on what motivates all this?
Well, first of all, I think the accusation that members of the Senate, either Democrat or Republican, are engaging in some form of religious bias, that is, bias against religiously motivated individuals, is really a red herring, and I think it's a slanderous charge against senators from either party. I think most senators are really thoughtful, they're analytical, they take the nomination of individuals to high office very seriously. They don't engage in that kind of blatant discrimination that I think most Americans would agree is abhorrent. We're a country based on Judeo-Christian values. Nonetheless, we are a country that has a broad tolerance for religious views. If you're Jewish, if you're Christian, if you're Muslim, if you have no religion, we have respect for your views, even though we may hold a different view. And I think to suggest that senators are somehow engaging in discrimination because they question the suitability of an individual for high office, not because of that individual's religious beliefs, but rather because of policy positions taken by that individual in the offices which he or she already holds, does seem to me is a terrible slander.
The focus has been on religion, as you just talked about, but what are your concerns about some of these more extremist judicial nominees that may get through if the nuclear option is carried out on the topic of civil rights, of affirmative action, yeah, and many other concerns that I know you work on?
Well, I'm very concerned. I mean, I know, for example, that two of the nominees who have been invoked by Senator Frist and used to gain sympathetic views about his proposal to change Senate rules have been Janice Rogers Brown, an African-American Supreme Court justice from California who has been nominated for a seat on the powerful D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and a woman named Priscilla Owen, who is a federal district court judge in Texas, who has been nominated for a seat on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the highest court governing the states of Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. And each of those individuals, because they are women, in one instance an African-American woman, and because they have very sympathetic personal stories of achievement, somehow that's being used as a substitute for evaluating the individual records of these women and the way in which they have engaged in decisions on the court. Janice Rogers Brown, for example, is really widely recognized as one of the most virulent ideologues on the California bench. In one case, she came down against 17 Hispanic workers who endured years of their boss hurling racial slurs at them in the workplace. And somehow she argued that racial slurs were a form of protected free speech, certainly not in the workplace. And, you know, that was a case of actual harassment on the job, and that decision was, in fact, vindicated for the plaintiffs in this case. In the case of Priscilla Owen, she has a hard-earned reputation of siding with corporate interests over the interests of everyday Americans. I mean, in one of her cases, a 14-year-old boy was rendered a quadriplegic after a seatbelt malfunction, and he was in a car accident. And Owen said on his case, even though both sides had requested prompt action, the auto company wanted action because it wanted to reverse a lower court judgment. And the young boy's family wanted action because it desperately needed the money for his child care. Unfortunately, Owen said on the case, too long, the young man died while awaiting a new trial. And, you know, from our perspective, these are just really, I think, examples of a more strident ideological bent that really is inappropriately rewarded with appointment to higher office. Both of these women serve as judges now. Both of them are in positions of responsibility in their respective states. And yet elevating them to positions on two of the most powerful courts in the country seems to be a perverse reward for not having given the due diligence that most Americans think is just an ordinary part of being a judge in our country.
That was Wade Henderson, Executive Director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. Contact the group by calling area code 202-466-3311 or visit their website at www.civilrights.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.